I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Florida Governor Charlie Crist just calls it ugly. Thick pools of oil baking in the Florida sun, making some beaches look like they're paved with ribbons of asphalt. Oil has now washed up on more than 30 miles of National Park and Pensacola Beach shorelines. Health advisories have been issued, but Florida officials are encouraging people to go to beaches that are still oil-free, and they're saying if not actual bathing, sunbathing is still an option where tar balls are floating in the water. Meanwhile, BP has managed to put its containment cap back over the broken well after that underwater robot banged into a vent. Henry Fountain is a science reporter for the New York Times. And Henry, first, just asking about the containment cap, this is the second time it had to be taken off the damaged well. Are there concerns this is going to be a continuing problem?
Well, you know, they're like everything else, they're doing everything at 5,000 feet underwater with robotic submersibles, and accidents do happen. I think the bigger fear is that our bigger concern is that they'll have to lift it for, you know, a week or more if a hurricane comes along.
Well, and now with the oil really washing up, it's like a mousse texture along the beaches in Pensacola. All eyes are even more on these relief wells that are being drilled. But we're hearing all sorts of rumors. So just if you could address them in any way you can. On Keith Olbermann's program last night, people, bloggers, saying that pipes beneath the seabed at the site of the gusher are unstable, that this whole thing could deteriorate before those relief wells can be built. Any credence?
Well, you know, there's a lot of speculation. There's been a lot of speculation since this whole event happened. What BP has told me and other people in the industry have told me is there's really no way of knowing the condition of the well underneath the seabed. They think things are okay. The blowout preventer is standing there. The top of it is not quite horizontal, but that's because of the, you know, the original sinking of the drill ship. You know, and BP has decided not to try to sort of cap the well and contain it permanently before the relief wells out of concern that they don't want to build up too much pressure in it. So, you know, there is some concern, but these rumors on the internet are really just based on speculation.
Well, and as you said, the relief wells are the hope for, you know, venting the oil from this gusher. You went aboard the Development Driller 2, and this is one of the rigs where crews are drilling one of those relief wells. What was it like? How's it going?
Well, they say it's going well. They say they're actually ahead of schedule, and they hope to have both wells done maybe even by late July. You know, I'd never been on an oil rig before, but they told me that it's basically there's not much difference between this drilling this well and drilling any well. You know, the same sort of 12-hour days. The workers are there for 3 weeks at a time, and then they have 3 weeks off. And they do pretty much the same thing they do. They drill, they put in a liner called casing, and then they drill some more. In this case, you know, the target isn't an oil reservoir. It's the target is the bad well about 18,000 feet below the below the surface of the Gulf.
And so there you were, you know, in the area where this spill is originating. What's it like out there? What, you know, we hear there's a smell and, you know, you just an obvious sense of disaster.
Yeah, I didn't really smell anything, but there's definitely an obvious sense of disaster. I mean, you know, the relief well rigs are pretty normal, but you just look about a half mile across the water, and there at the exact place where the Deepwater Horizon was, there's this 900-foot-long drill ship that's spewing, it's got this enormous flame where it's flaring the gas from the containment cap below. And then next to that, there's another rig that's burning oil and gas in this giant sort of flower of flame with some soot rising off of it. So it's, you know, it's sort of Dante-esque in a way.
And we understand, you know, dozens of ships out there, oil skimmers, supply boats, support ships. But we're hearing criticism, and just wondering what you're hearing, that some of the skimming is not at the level that it could be, that these are little fishing boats, that there should be more of a sense of, you know, huge ships coming in to help with gathering up this oil that, again, is now hitting Pensacola beaches. What are you hearing?
Well, I think that's a reference to somebody has an idea to bring in some super tankers and basically suck up a lot of oil and water, you know, millions and millions of gallons of it. That creates lots of other problems. It creates a big water problem, water storage problem. But I think it's definitely true that skimmers are not very effective. I have a story actually running in tomorrow's paper about how cleanup technology really hasn't progressed in the, you know, in the 2 decades since the Exxon Valdez disaster.
Right. Right. And so there is that criticism. Well, in the meantime, given that criticism, this so-called nuclear option seems to have reemerged. Christopher Brownfield, former nuclear submarine officer, wrote an op-ed in The Times, your paper, saying the government should have a backup plan detonating several tons of explosives to collapse the well in on itself and stop the flow that way. We heard this early on, then it seemed to go away. Is it back?
Well, he wasn't talking about nuclear weapons, and I think the nuclear idea has been pretty much disposed of. He was talking about conventional weapons. You know, it's been done on some wells on land, and it's been done in other countries occasionally. The risk that it entails is that you'd end up, it wouldn't work, and you'd end up with a totally uncontrolled situation and, you know, no hope of controlling it at the seabed. As long as you have the blowout preventer there and you have the well structure, you have this ability to put a containment cap or put other piping on it. But if you blow it up and it doesn't work, you just got a big hole in the ground spewing oil.
Yeah, bigger than the one that already is. Henry Fountain,
yeah.
Science reporter for The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
To Afghanistan. President Obama's choice of General David Petraeus to take over command of the Afghan war is being called a political masterstroke. It's winning almost universal praise in Congress. It's also being called a continuation of current policy. But will it be? That policy was already running into problems with a delay in this summer's planned attack on the Taliban in Kandahar. Yesterday's change in leadership is also said to be exposing deepening fault lines on just how to move forward. So let's take a look at that today, starting with former CIA officer Bruce Riedel, who led President Obama's 2009 strategy review of the war in Afghanistan. Bruce is now a senior foreign policy fellow at the Brookings Institution. And Bruce, let's get some definitions in. Petraeus wrote the book on the current strategy, counterinsurgency, or COIN, this idea of more troops, but protecting the civilians to win them over from the Taliban. McChrystal wrote the rules of engagement for COIN. You know, don't kill the Taliban if you might kill civilians. But we understand troops are chafing under those restrictions. So do you have a sense, just an overarching sense, that Petraeus is going to continue this policy as we understand it?
Well, General Petraeus is very much the architect of this policy. He was a key player in the strategic review that I chaired for the president in February and March of 2009, an advocate of the COIN strategy. He was General McChrystal's boss for the last year in Afghanistan as head of Central Command. I don't foresee any significant shifts in strategy and policy. But I would also say this, David Petraeus is a man who knows how to adapt and how to change tactics when you think you see something that's better come up on the horizon. And I think he'll be flexible as he moves forward over the course of the next year.
Oopsie, a little barking there. Well, the other thinking we should say is CT, or counterterrorism. And this is Vice President Biden's call for a smaller troop force. We don't mind the dog, by the way, so don't do anything to the dog to make him stop. This is Vice President Joe Biden's call for a smaller troop force, but more targeted attacks against the Taliban. Now, the criticism is that sometimes they take out civilians by mistake. And you know, because you were in this three-month-long Afghan strategy review, you know the tension between this kind of thinking. So, you know, some are interpreting what just happened this week as maybe moving Joe Biden's thinking a little bit forward. Your thoughts on that?
I don't think so. I think that what happened yesterday is that General Petraeus has been given a pretty clear mandate from the president to go out and see if he can make it happen. This is his strategy. This is the troop level that as central commander, he thought made sense. I would go a little bit further than that, too. I think that the question of whether or not there's going to be a significant drawdown in American forces in the summer of 2011 may have also been resolved yesterday. And I think it may have been resolved in favor of General Petraeus, who's been saying very clearly in Hill testimony and in other interviews that he doesn't think we should have a hard and fast date in July 2011. We ought to see what the situation looks like on the ground.
But on the other hand, I got to jump in and say today on CNN, General Petraeus said that he did support this timeline. You're right. You know, when he was appearing before Congress last week, he made a stir, first of all, by fainting. He was dehydrated, but also then indicating he wasn't maybe behind this President Obama's July 2011 timeline, but today says he is.
Well, I think that you're going to see this general be very careful about what he says in public. He's learned a few lessons from Rolling Stone magazine.
Right, and when he spoke before Congress, we just want to underscore he was not the top commander in Afghanistan as of yesterday. He is.
That's right, and I think that Petraeus knows that in a counterinsurgency, it's very hard to win just to start with, and to try to say, well, we're going to succeed within what is now 13 months is asking an awful lot of troops, of commanders, of diplomats. If we are showing success in the summer of 2011, then we may be able to make some modest troop withdrawals.
Yeah.
But I think that time to make that decision is 2011, not 2010.
Yeah. So that deadline maybe doesn't seem as hard and fast. But I just want to get from you in the couple minutes we have. You were, as we said, in this three-month-long Afghan strategy review, several meetings. And people, we understand, were chafing at General Petraeus's frequent analogies from Iraq. And at one point, the president turned to Petraeus and said, well, what can we learn from Iraq? Is there anything he said that you think we're now going to see?
Well, I think what one lesson from Petraeus' experiences in Iraq is that unity of command and unity of effort is absolutely critical. You'll recall that in 2007, he had a partner in Ambassador Ryan Crocker, the American ambassador to Iraq, and the two of them worked almost constantly as a team, Petraeus working the military side of issues and Crocker working the civilian side of issues. And we all saw that dramatically when they testified together on the Hill. Mm. We haven't had that teamwork in Afghanistan for the last year and a half.
As illustrated by the Rolling Stone magazine interview.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think one of the things Petraeus is going to try very hard to do is to make that kind of teamwork happen.
Yeah, even though Tom Ricks, Wall Street Journal, Senators John McCain, Lindsey Graham, calling for a change in the diplomatic leadership in Afghanistan. At one point, the administration was talking about one person being both the civilian and military leader.
Whether such changes are in the works, I can't say. Whether the personalities will work themselves out in the field themselves, we don't know. But I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see some more personnel changes, because the president has rightly identified this as his number one national security priority.
Yeah.
Well, he ought to have his best team working together flawlessly, if that is just the case.
Bruce Riedel, Senior Foreign Policy Fellow at the Brookings Institution, who did lead Obama's strategy review in Afghanistan and Pakistan last year, weighing in on this week's changes. Bruce, thanks so much as always.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And when we come back, should there be two strategies in Afghanistan, here and now?
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're taking a couple of minutes today to take a look at Afghanistan, now that there's a new general in command, even though he has the same strategy as the old general. In fact, he wrote it. We turn now to journalist Spencer Ackerman, senior reporter for Wired.com's Danger Room blog. And Spencer, we've been reading the blogs. You join the pundits who say picking General Petraeus is intensifying the counterinsurgency strategy, this idea of going after hearts and minds and limited targeting of the Taliban if, in fact, civilians will be killed. But you write that there might have to be two strategies, counterinsurgency in the south, this idea of winning the hearts and minds, but counterterrorism, targeting insurgents, in the east, the border with Pakistan. Tell us more.
Well, I was writing that if you look at General McChrystal's tenure in Afghanistan, It wasn't so much that there needs to be two strategies, it's that two strategies developed, which is, as you say, in the South, focus on securing the population from violence, whether from insurgents or from accidental and inadvertent civilian casualties caused by U.S. and NATO action. But in the East, where the strategy before McChrystal used to focus on the border areas in the East, Paktia province, in Khost province, with Pakistan, combating the terrorist infiltration networks and insurgent infiltration networks there was a reduced priority and a bifurcated priority for McChrystal. And to fill the gap where there wasn't the great troop increases that you would see in the South, he turned to more highly violent raids by special forces that got a little bit too violent and caused some very damaging civilian casualties. So he reined them in somewhat. So a big question for General Petraeus when he testifies next week to the Senate is whether that de facto splitting strategy is going to persist.
Well, in fact, there's Karen DeYoung's reporting in, I believe, Time magazine that this idea of special ops, secret special ops teams is far bigger in the Obama administration than it was in the Bush administration, that the military is feeling that the Obama administration has been open to it, and there's much more of it going on then we know. So that was confusing to us because it seems as if, at least secretly, the Obama administration is going in that direction.
That's right. And one of the reasons that it's had such a hard time maintaining popular support for the Afghanistan war is because the focus of the war under General Petraeus and General McChrystal, and now especially General Petraeus again, has been somewhat disconnected from the disrupt, dismantle, and destroy al-Qaeda mantra that operations in Afghanistan are supposed to support. After all, right now, the nexus for al-Qaeda's senior leadership is in neighboring Pakistan. And it's unclear to a lot of people how exactly protecting the population in southern Afghanistan relates to that central focus on al-Qaeda.
Yeah. Quick questions for you. Newsweek magazine's Michael Hirsch says, to some critics in the military, General Petraeus' counterinsurgency strategy has almost become a cult in the Pentagon. It stunts fresh ways of thinking, and that counterinsurgency has a special allure for liberal thinkers because it offers what sounds to them like a holistic approach to war, emphasizing hearts and minds and incorporating diplomacy and a civilian arm to the war effort. When in reality, counterinsurgency can be the nastiest, most grueling, most long-running kind of war. You are out with the populace and you don't know who the insurgents are. Your thoughts on that criticism, again, from within the military?
I think Michael makes a fair point and then a bit of an unfair one. The fair point is that from the seeming rhetoric of counterinsurgency, not so much winning hearts and minds, but winning stomachs and wallets and focusing for stable security and sustainable security over the long term on development work and political operations and partnership with foreign peoples, it has made, to some degree, protracted wars safe for liberalism and safe for liberals. And that bill is coming due in Afghanistan. Where I think he goes a little bit far is to say that it's a cult. Because if it's a cult, then President Obama is a member. This isn't just General Petraeus' strategy. It's not just General McChrystal's strategy. It's President Obama's strategy. It's Secretary Gates' strategy. It's Undersecretary Flournoy's strategy. It's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's strategy. So it's not really right to say that this is something within the military that's being imposed on a civilian leadership that's impotent to stop it. Where there might be an opportunity for some greater calibration is to say that with General Petraeus spreading counterinsurgency doctrine in the military, it gave a military that was very weary from a confusing fight in Iraq a cohesive, understandable framework for successful operations. That benefited a great deal from exogenous events in Iraq, like the Sunni-Iraqi shift away from al-Qaeda, But it nevertheless gave a lot of morale and a template for success to a military that hadn't racked up very many in a sustainable way in Iraq.
Right, leaders in Iraq shifting away from the Taliban, that hasn't happened in Afghanistan, that idea of civilians taking it, taking up arms against the insurgents. But, you say it gave relief. It seems as if the chafing is back. You know, Rolling Stone journalist Michael Hastings on the Today Show today said he's getting emails from troops applauding the article that they say brought down General McChrystal because they don't agree with this tightening of the rules of engagement for troops. Do you think that's going to shift? And we only have a few seconds. Sorry to throw that at you.
I would imagine there would be some small modifications of it. General Petraeus is very attuned to troop morale, so I would expect that he would modify it but not get rid of it.
And again, because he wrote the book on counterinsurgency. That's journalist Spencer Ackerman, senior reporter for Wired.com's Danger Room blog. We'll link you. Terrific writing there, Spencer. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
We also spoke with Bruce Riedel, senior foreign policy fellow at the Brookings Institution. Well, coming up, that tennis match, it's finally over. The American left standing just barely. We'll have that and much more after the latest news here and now. A controversial school policy in tiny Provincetown, Massachusetts, on the tip of Cape Cod, is making big headlines across the country, and it's a story you might not want to have to explain to your little kids if they're listening. But starting in September, free condoms will be available to all kids in Provincetown public schools. All kids, all grades, if they ask for them. Here's School Superintendent Beth Singer.
The advantage is that they get to have a conversation. They get information, which you don't get over the counter of the cashier.
Now, there are only 152 kids total in the Provincetown school system, and officials are stressing little kids in particular will have to pass a screening by the school nurse, after which they more than likely won't get any condoms. But the fact that condoms are even being offered and parents can't overrule the decision to hand them out has a lot of people outside of Provincetown enraged. So what's happening in town? Marianne Bragg is with the Cape Cod Times. She's in Provincetown. Marianne, as you know, talk radio has been going to town on this, but what are people saying on the streets of P-Town?
Well, I live here in Provincetown, and I can't say it's a huge topic. I did have a chance to speak with one parent late yesterday afternoon. She has two children in the school system, age 7 and 11, and she said more that she hadn't quite heard enough information about the decision by the school committee, so she wasn't able really to kind of make a decision for herself what she thought about it.
So it sort of hasn't even obviously been driven to find that information. The biggest criticism that we're hearing from other groups, like the Conservative Massachusetts Family Institute, saying what's next, birth control pills to little kids, you know, is that this is being offered to all grades. Now, we know Superintendent Singer says they won't be advertising it to little kids, but they're sure to hear about it from the big kids. So how is the school justifying the decision to offer it to all ages, kindergarten, first grade?
Well, I think, first of all, the school committee decided not to set a specific minimum age because, as the Peter Grosso, who's the chairman of the school committee, said, it's hard to say when sexual activity will begin. So they were reluctant to actually say, well, only through the fourth grade or sixth grade or whatever. So that was kind of the first step. The other thing, just to set the context a little bit, the school district basically is composed of two buildings, and there's a big reorganization going on in the district where they're going to be closing the high school in the next few years, and they'll be using those two buildings, one what used to be the high school and one what used to be the elementary, in a more of a blended way. And so as Beth Singer said, the superintendent, she said that traditionally these types of policies have been building specific, like for a high school. But in Provincetown, come September, there is going to be a much more of a blended use of the two buildings. And as she said, it's not such a building-specific type
right.
of school district.
So they didn't know how to geographically draw the line, and they didn't want to draw the line age-wise, so they just didn't put one in. And they also are going out of their way to say that anyone who makes this request has to go through the school nurse. If they're young kids, they're going to be asked questions, and in all likelihood, they won't get them?
As I understand it, if a kid comes in and maybe it's a joke, maybe it's a sixth grader kind of asking, that they will have to ask for it through a school nurse. But Peter Grosso, the school committee chairman, said that really on a practical level, they just totally doubted that they would be getting a first or second grader asking for a condom in kind of in a practical, you know, real-life way.
Well, and as to the idea that parents have no say in this, the school officials say they have to keep a child's request confidential, and they're bound by that. So do you think that this is something that is definitely causing more consternation outside of Provincetown than in?
I think for the moment it is. As I think I mentioned, I'm not getting a sense that this is kind of a conversation that's really coming up a lot in town for the moment.
Yeah, we'll see what happens in the fall. That's Marianne Bragg with the Cape Cod Times speaking to us from Provincetown, Massachusetts. Marianne, thanks so much.
All right, take care.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow in Here and Now. Have been a year, well, in the year since his death, Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror is one of the most popular songs on iTunes. He sold 4 million albums more than Taylor Swift last year. A Cirque du Soleil tour with his music is being planned. We're going to check in on the Jackson legacy. That's tomorrow. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now.
It is over. 3-6, 7-6, 6-7, 70-68.
Did you hear that? 3-6, 7-6, 6-7, 70-68. And with that final winning backhand, American John Isner has triumphed in the longest tennis match in professional history, winning 3 sets to 2 with 70 games to 68 in the fifth set. An ESPN commentator called it an attritional slugfest. Here to hear more about it, Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game. Boy, we haven't had gotten a lot of work done.
You know, that bit of tape that you just played was the sound that some people had begun to fear that they would never hear.
Yeah, the end.
The end.
It's just amazing. 11 hours, 5 minutes, 138 games, stretched over 3 days, more than 200 aces. He called his opponent, Frenchman Nicolas Mahou, an absolute warrior, and that's so true. Here's John Isner after his win.
Got a little bit tired, but, you know, when you come out and play a match like this and with the atmosphere like this, you don't feel tired really out here, even though that's exactly what we both were. This crowd was fantastic. So,
Bill, what happened here? Explain, you know, for those who understand tennis, how do they keep it going?
Well, I think basically what happened was tennis on this day revealed itself as a game in which the server has an absolutely tremendous advantage.
Yeah, because they both...
they held serve more held times serve than anybody could possibly have imagined. And I don't believe Mr. Isner for a minute when he says you don't get tired out here under these circumstances. I think both of these guys must be completely spent.
Well, it's going to be interesting to find out what they did physically and mentally to keep going. I mean, Isner, you know, he's not a small man.
No, big guy. And, you know,
somebody
said it looked like he was serving from the roof of a tall building when you had to play him.
And by the way, I mean, historic, but has anything even come close?
I don't think there's been anything even close. I think that if you look back, there may have been, you know, there's a match back with Pancho Gonzalez was involved in some years ago, right, that went for 6 hours and 50 minutes or something like that, but not a match that was extended over 3 days. You know, you look at this story and you'd say, oh, okay, Wimbledon, a match that took 3 days to complete. I guess they had some rain, since they generally do at Wimbledon.
No, that's not the answer in this case.
They just played a lot of tennis.
Everybody watching Kobe Bryant. Twitter was going crazy. The University of Georgia, where Isner went to school, everybody's gathering around. Is there a question, though, about whether they might change some of the rules? Because in the fifth set, there's no tiebreaker.
No, and of course, a tiebreaker can go on for a while as well. You can have a long match even when there is a tiebreaker in the final set. But I think, all things considered, there is a case to be made for adopting the tiebreaker. That's why they invented the darn thing years ago, to prevent matches from going on forever.
I would vote. I am a fellow of a certain age, I'll grant you. Young fellows may enjoy this more than I, but time is running out. I don't have 3 days to watch a tennis match.
Okay, we'll continue to cover to Wimbledon, but in just a few seconds we have defending champion Italy eliminated in the World Cup.
Astonishing. It has been an incredible World Cup, incredibly bad World Cup for teams from Europe. France has gone home. Italy is going home. Spain needs to play well to prevent, to avoid going home tomorrow. And the Latin American teams are all looking relatively strong.
Even though the U.S. did win on that final seconds kick. We knew that. You know how we knew that? We heard Bill Littlefield yelling over the wall.
Yes, I'm afraid they heard me as far north as and west as Utica and as far south as Savannah.
Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's take a second and get a couple of your thoughts in here. Richard Curran called after I said how much I love saying those Wisconsin towns like Wauwatosa, where my cousins live, or Waukesha. Rut-row, here's Richard.
Sorry, Robin, you got it wrong. It's Waukesha.
Waukesha, of course. Sorry. Charlene Muhlenhardt of Lawrence, Kansas wrote, when another listener used the phrase, there are no atheists in a foxhole, Charlene thinks the phrase is insulting, and she writes, it's also false. There are atheists in foxholes. Well, we've also had a couple of Louisiana business people on the program saying that calling a moratorium on deepwater drilling because of the BP well blowout would be like grounding the entire airline industry because of one plane crash. Well, this drove many of you nuts, so we called up Scott Simmons of Philadelphia. Scott, you say plane crashes are devastating, but...
For me, the real issue is that a plane crash is a defined event. And in this particular case, it's been over 60 days, and we still don't have any resolution, and we still don't have the technology to fix it. You understand the people that it's happening to. I'm sure that the people at the Toyota dealers didn't want their cars to be taken off the road. You know, it's so personal to them. I mean, this is really something that could, look at it spreading to Florida, it could come up the coast.
Right. The Gulf Gusher is spreading far and wide, and we don't know its effects. But you also point out that there have been times that all planes have been grounded.
Certainly, after the events of 9/11, when we just simply did not know the scope of what would happen if we continued flying flights,
right,
or with the volcanic eruption.
So the analogy doesn't hold for you there. And it's not that you don't have sympathy for the business people in the Gulf.
No, I think that the real problem is that you can't oversimplify what's happening and say that if we continue drilling tomorrow and there's 30 or more other possible events that can happen, and they happen in a place where we simply don't have the technology to fix them, what is the cost to the rest of the world for how long?
Scott, well, thank you so much for weighing in on that.
Thank you very much.
Staying with the gusher in the Gulf, Celine Grenier of Capitola, California writes, we ignored, even ridiculed, President Carter's warnings 30 years ago that we were then in an energy crisis. Don't want government telling us what to do, do we? Now even more people are dependent on oil-related industry, and oil companies have even more power over our politics. We're like the people of an ancient civilization who destroyed themselves through deforestation and used their last trees and ceremonies to appeal to the gods to save them. And finally, Gail Sidney was one of many listeners who wanted to know the name of this song. Well, so do we. We know it's by an artist named Mogwai, but what's it called? If you know, or if you have any comments or questions, go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us to send an email, or leave a comment right there. Back in a minute, Here and Now. Welcome back.
Come all ye fair and tender ladies.
Almost hidden among the blockbusters and sequels this summer box office season is Winter's Bone, an indie gem which won the Grand Jury Prize and much of the buzz at the Sundance Film Festival. The movie stars Jennifer Lawrence as Ree Dolly, a teenager eking out a hardscrabble existence in the Ozark Mountains of Missouri. Ree takes care of her younger siblings and her mentally ill mother after her father, Jessup, disappears. A job that gets even harder when the local sheriff shows up on Ree's porch and tells her that Dad is also a bail jumper.
Where you all come into this is, he put this house here and your timbreakers up for his bond.
He what now?
Jessup signed over everything. If he doesn't show at trial, see, the way the deal works is y'all gonna lose this place.
So Ree sets out to find her father and save her family home. A dangerous quest because pretty much everybody she goes to for answers in her extended family is, like Dad, involved in the local crystal meth trade. They have a code of silence and no hesitation about using violence to protect themselves, even against kin. Winter's Bone is based on the novel by Daniel Woodrell and was co-written and directed by Deborah Granick. It also stars John Hawkes as Ree's Uncle Teardrop. The New York Times called his work in Winter's Bone one of the breakthrough performances of the summer. On a recent visit to Boston, director Granick and actor John Hawkes both sat down with Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa, who asked Deborah about the gritty realism of the film, set and shot in the Ozark Mountains.
To do this project, it required us grounding it in a real place, and we didn't waver from our desire to shoot in southern Missouri because the book is written in great detail. We almost felt desperate to get as close as we could. You know, I felt like sometimes like kind of clawing the gravel, if you will, because it's like that gravel, that sound of that gravel, the dust that it throws up, sort of the way that Teardrops learn to drive on it. You know, all those things we needed to make the story come to life.
And John Hawkes, you're shooting this in a place where you're not going to have a trailer or, you know, some of the amenities. Does it help you with your character?
For Teardrop, it was especially important to have, for me, to have a sense of missing things and an incompleteness and not everything there. So to that end, I'm not a method actor, but I didn't bring enough winter clothing purposefully. I didn't bring books to read, things I would normally love to do in off time. I let myself kind of hang.
And the thing about your character, Teardrop, and his relationship to Ree, it's fascinating to watch over the course of the film because you're never quite certain at any point if he's going to give her a hug or if he's going to kill her. I mean, either possibility seems to be there in certain moments.
That's true, and I felt that was really important to the story, that he's a real complicator, seemingly, to her journey, that he's an obstacle, that he is someone who we don't know yet. We don't know what he's going to do to her or with her.
Jesus. Dad's your only brother.
You think I forgot that? Jess and me run together for coming on 40 years, but I don't know where he's at, and I ain't going to go around asking after him neither.
A lot of the characters are involved in or addicted to crystal meth. It's, you know, just sort of underneath the surface and then very apparent at other times. We've heard a little bit that the crystal meth, you know, in recent years has been less of a problem and replaced by things like OxyContin. But you actually talked to a sheriff when you were researching this film about the meth problem in that area.
Daniel Woodrell's novel and the film never felt like it was something to pin on this region in any way particularly, but yet it is an obstacle. In addition to other obstacles that a family like Ree's family might face, that is definitely one of them that would have brushed by in the last decade and a half. And what I found most intense when I did meet that sheriff was that so many, there's no other. So many of the people that he had arrested and so many places where he had gone where there was evidence of meth use and meth damage were classmates of his, you know. So it was, there was nothing about triumphs of stings or, you know, nothing like that. It was sort of this raw, personal, gruesome journey he had to take, a form of a death and destruction beat, if you will.
We seen the law was out here this afternoon. Everything all right?
He's hunting for Dad.
Hunting Jessup, is he? You know where he's at?
No.
You sure about that?
Yes.
All right. All right, well, I guess you didn't have nothing to tell him then, did you?
I wouldn't tell him nothing if I did.
Well, the thing that about this film that I thought was so interesting was all of its ideas of family. What is family, I think? The family is something you want to go to, but this particular family, and also just because this extended family is also so dangerous.
That's sort of Ree's little insight into the sort of the best part of her family is that you learn some good things, some very solid good things. Certain things I do. I protect my family. I stand on my porch, and I've been told that I don't let people enter just because they claim they have a right to. You know, that I feel fierce. I'm a lioness, you know, or something. I protect my little ones. I feel like the danger gets so augmented and almost, if you want, poisoned by this notion whenever a family starts to be involved in illegal activity and there's money and there's stakes involved. And it's not unique to the Ozarks by any means. I mean, we think globally people do attempt to make money all over the world, especially in hardscrabble situations. And some of those practices end up dividing people very, very viciously.
What is it you want?
I got a real bad need to talk with Thump.
And he ain't got no need to talk to you.
But I need to. I really, really got to, ma'am, please. Some of our blood at least is the same. Ain't that supposed to mean something?
What do you want people to take from this film?
I'm not sure exactly what I want them to take other than to be, hopefully be transported to a place they may not know well. Most of us don't. I still don't. I know a little bit more about it having been there, but I hope that people will take the journey with Ree and the rest of us, and hopefully it matters somehow to people.
One thing that touched us so much and was unexpected, unplanned, was being very infected by the beautiful music that is extremely prevalent in the Ozark region. Music is a kind of medicine, and it's been a long-running tradition. And so we tried to also, in this film that deals with a hardscrabble life and a very difficult set of circumstances, to make sure that there was also glimpses of some of the lyricism. So trying to also find very important, undeniably sweet strands of existence that can happen in what I would call a life with very little buffer.
Hush, goodbye, my baby, slumber time is coming soon. Rest your head upon my breast while mama hums a tune.
Deborah Granick, I wanted to ask you, this is a lovely little film, but in a way it's not, I don't know, it's not Avatar. You know, I mean, is this the way, though, that you as a director want to continue to work?
I don't need for the budgets of the films I get involved to get so much bigger. I don't need anyone to make any form of profit. I do need people to make a living wage. I do need to meet all union obligations. We could still find rich and complicated stories, hungry, super talented, excellent actors that are willing to take a risk, and we could keep going and try to tell, you know, kind of fierce American stories. They don't have to be American. I'm just saying right now I am very, very, very invested in trying to tell more stories from different regions here. But so it's not that anything has to get grandiose, but they have to just meet this one little bar, which is pay back the brave people that invest.
They're like the stars on a summer.